Welcome to Plan VTV, the show about Vermont independence. I'm Rob Williams, the publisher of VermontIndependent.net. And with us via Zoom in our two-camera studio today, we have none other than New York University Professor of Communications, Mark Crispin Miller. Mark, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Rob.
If only virtually. We wish you were here in person.
Yeah, don't I wish the same.
So I'm going to jump right in with this, Mark. We want to talk today about academic freedom in the time of the COVID. Mm. And you have a particularly interesting story to tell, and I'm going to let you tell it, but I want to read the petition that is currently up and gathering many signatures from your colleagues around the world. This petition has to do with academic freedom and your teaching at New York University. So I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs. The first paragraph, and you can find, for our listeners and viewers, you can find this petition at VermontIndependent.net, and we have linked to it in the show notes here. So the petition reads, "We, the undersigned, support the academic freedom of Professor Mark Crispin Miller, now under siege at New York University, for urging students in his propaganda course to read scientific literature on the effectiveness of masks against transmission of COVID-19. We see his situation as but one example of a growing global trend toward rigid censorship of expert views on urgent subjects of all kinds. So this petition is not just in his defense, but a protest on behalf of all professors, doctors, scientists, and journalists who have been gagged or punished for the rights to freely research, study, and interpret data on a wide variety of matters, regardless of their controversial nature." And then the last two paragraphs. "We see Professor Miller's situation as a flashpoint in the struggle not just to reclaim, but to protect free speech and free inquiry. New York University officials have no right to intervene in Professor Miller's courses or message his students surreptitiously, undermining his integrity as an instructor. They have no right to deprive him of the courses he was hired to teach, and they should not join in a public smear campaign against the very rights they should uphold at a university. That so stated, we urge that New York University respect his academic freedom and thereby set a good example for all other schools with faculty who dare contest official narratives. Otherwise, education there will be mere training for compliance, stunting students' minds instead of opening them, a practice fatal to democracy and finally to humanity itself." And then there's a link to the background story. And again, the petition can be found at change.org, and we have linked to it in several places where we are as well. So I'm going to open up our Zoom here, Mark. There we go.
Yeah.
So again, welcome to our show. And start by giving us kind of the backstory about this petition. You have been teaching at NYU for many, many years. You and I have known each other for a long time. You've done incredibly courageous work as a public intellectual, and we've detailed that in our posts about the petition. But how did this situation come to be?
Well, it took me by surprise. I teach a propaganda course almost every semester, sometimes two if one of them is for the master's students. And my view is that propaganda is not an academic subject, and that if you treat it as such, you're not really studying it. Now, you know, commonly college and university courses on propaganda focus on the Soviets and the Nazis. Sometimes they'll go back to World War I. Mm. But that's misleading. In a sense, it is itself propagandistic to treat it that way, because it suggests that propaganda is a totalitarian thing. It's something they do in China. It's something they do in North Korea. It doesn't happen here. Mm. And in fact, it happens especially here. That propaganda is actually an Anglo-American innovation. I mean, governments have been using forms of it for centuries, but it was the British who were the first to rationalize it and sort of discover it in its most effective form. That was in World War I, in the campaign to demonize the Germans, Germany as the Hun.
The Hun, yes.
Whip up war fever through, you know, many, many devices, including a whole slew of outrageous lies about German atrocities. lies that everybody believed. It was a moment very similar to the present in that sense. And then the practice was picked up in the United States. The British interests pushing for war were very close to their American counterparts. So yeah, we don't have to get into the politics of the whole thing, but it is an Anglo-American innovation. That's political propaganda, and the same is true with commercial propaganda, which we call advertising. It was the British and the Americans who really perfected that. Well, if you're going to study propaganda in any meaningful way, which is to say, if you're going to study it in order to prepare people to be able to recognize it and to assess its veracity and then figure out what interests are behind it and what its purpose is, if you're going to do that, you have to grapple with propaganda drives ongoing at the moment when the course is going on. Now, until this year, that was not that difficult. You could talk about Russiagate, for example. You could talk about the claims that Assad had gassed his own people. You could talk about that. You could even talk about, I mean, in my classes, you could talk about Israel, Zionism, vaccines. These are hot button issues. They're sort of third rail issues. But if you encourage a kind of openness to different points of view and insist that people study each example on its own merits, and make clear that it's really up to them to do this. It's up to them to do the research. It's up to them to figure out whether it's true or false. Learn how to do that, so that I'm not an oracle. I'm not telling them what to think. I'm setting an example of a certain kind of investigation. You know, you're doing the right thing, and even with those hot button issues, it really hasn't been that difficult. This is different. Okay, what's going on now is in a class by itself. It is unprecedented. It is a global propaganda drive of absolutely unprecedented sophistication, and one that invokes a bogey, a demon that is far more terrifying than certainly than the communists were in the 50s, than the terrorists were, you know, starting 20 years ago. Those amorphous evils were frightening enough to people, but the virus is far more pervasive and terrifying. And I'm not suggesting that there's no virus. I mean, this is a complicated issue. I actually believe there is a virus. I believe it's was lab made, and it has killed people. I lost a friend to it, almost lost another friend to it. I'm well aware of the dubiousness of the tests. The testing is a joke. But I'm not saying that the virus is a hoax. What's a hoax is the magnification of the danger. It is astonishing to me how abundant and solid the evidence is that every aspect of the narrative we've been given is completely false. And more astonishing how little effect that evidence has on many, many highly intelligent people. Okay, that's kind of a prelude to my account of what happened to me.
Yeah, and we'll circle back around to that. But yeah, set up your situation. That was a fantastic prelude, and I hope we have time to come back to it. Yeah.
Okay. My department chair called me on the phone and asked me, "Is it true that you talked about the masks not being effective against the virus?" And I said, "Well, I encourage the class to read scientific studies, eight or so randomized controlled tests that have been conducted and the results published over the last 15 years or so that have found that the masks cannot prevent transmission of respiratory viruses." I did talk about that.
And let me jump in. I know that Denis Rancourt in Ontario has done some really good work about this, for example.
Well, his work is pioneering, and he introduced me to this literature. Mm-hmm. Seven of the eight pieces I'm referring to were in his April summary of which he called provocatively "Masks Don't Work."
Yeah.
Okay, and it was masks and ventilators, and I mean the science suggests that he's right. Mm. But I had encouraged the students to read those. I also encouraged them to read studies claiming otherwise, and gave them some guidance as to how to assess their accuracy. Mm. I mean, they're not scientists, but they can read scientists' reviews, and they can also look into the research teams that do these other studies to see if their universities have partnerships with Big Pharma or get money from the Gates Foundation. Mm. So you can start to figure out if there are conflicts of interest there. So I did all that. I said all that in this class. Mm. And my chair said, well, a student has tweeted, she's upset with this, and the COVID response team or whatever NYU's bureaucratic flying squad of enforcers calls itself, he said they're going to be responding. I didn't know what any of this meant. So I went and looked at the tweets, and this was a stream of livid tweets from a student who had joined the class late. She missed the first two or three classes and therefore missed my introductory discussion of what we were doing. She also missed the beginning of our discussion of masks because I had brought it up early on as an example of the kind of thing we need to think rationally about and not just accept on faith. She missed all that and was present for the resumption of that discussion. Mm. Didn't say a word during that class. Mm. Well, in retrospect, I seem to remember her staring stonily at me. You know, this is on Zoom, of course. So her glare wasn't modified by a mask or anything. So she a few days later tweeted that NYU should fire me for this. That's what she demanded, that NYU fire me for what she called, I'm blanking on what she called it. Oh, an unhealthy amount of skepticism around health professionals. That's what she said I was guilty of. I mean, all the studies were by health professionals, but this was not a rational response. Mm. And she went off. It was not just the one tweet, but she was enraged that when she called the bias hotline at NYU to report me for bias, I guess, against health professionals, they told her rightly that there was nothing they could do about it. Mm. And this incensed her. And she demanded to know why NYU officials would fob off a student who has this legitimate concern. Then she took a lot of screenshots from my website, News from Underground, various posts, you know, from Global Research and Technocracy and other outlets, and presented them as self-evidently false and malicious, and said that they had all come from right-wing or conspiracy sites, which, you know, maybe one of them is conservative, none of them is right wing. Conspiracy is something she might have learned about if she had stuck with the class, because we're going to be talking about conspiracy theory. At any rate, there's a stream of really venomous tweets. Yeah. And it immediately provoked a tweet storm, many, many people attacking her. And a fair number attacking me. One of the people thanking her was my department chair, who tweeted an assurance to her that we as a department have made this a priority and are discussing next steps. This really took me aback. Mm. I mean, I guess I would have thought that the department would at least consult me, you know. I mean, as it happens, I believe I'm the senior member of that very large department. I mean, that's neither here nor there, but any colleague should have been at least consulted. They apparently met and discussed making this a priority. And the way it read, the way it reads, because he has refused to take the tweet down.
And I'm right in saying you've been teaching in that program at least 20 years. Is that right, Mark?
Well, since 1997.
Yeah.
I've been there a long time.
And Notes from Underground is your kind of newsletter site, which is fantastic, by the way. Notes from
Thank
Underground.
You. Yeah. But news from
Underground. Sorry, News from Underground. It's News from Underground dot.
But it's markcrispinmiller.com.
Thank you. Yeah.
You're confusing me with Dostoevsky.
Yes, well, you know, an easy mistake. so back to the department chair, yeah.
Yeah, so he, you know, they weighed in that way. And that was really shocking to me. Then, though, in a way worse, the dean of the school that I teach in, which is called the Steinhardt School, and a doctor who advises them on their COVID policy, emailed my students without putting me on copy, you know, starting with a ritual nod to academic freedom, just big of them, and then intimating that I had given the students dangerous misinformation and urging them, it's more accurate to say telling them to read the authoritative CDC's list of studies. There was a link to those studies as a kind of corrective to the poison that I had given them. Mm. And the studies are, you know, it's kind of sloppy and suppositious and, you know, tentative. I mean, they're not very good and they're not rigorous. But here is the dean of the school jumping into my class and undermining me, treating me as kind of a liar or reckless, and then reminding them that NYU has a strict rule about masking in campus buildings. Now, I had said explicitly to the class, I am not telling you not to wear masks. This is not what I'm asking you to do. You know, NYU has this rule. I observe the rule. You should observe the rule. But I, you know, my belief is that we should at least be informed about these things and think about their scientific basis. Okay, so that happened. And then the third and final blow was that the chair asked me to cancel the propaganda course next term, okay? And his rationale was transparently ridiculous. He said, it would be better for the department if you teach two sections of your film course because those classes have high enrollments, and so we'll have more students in the program. Well, the film classes that I teach are no higher enrolled than the propaganda course, which is always fully enrolled as well, and it has students waitlisted. Mm. And I try to let them in, you know, the more the merrier. So that is just an excuse to get rid of a course that someone, some parties want to see stopped. And it's not the first time this year that there's been an attempt against that course and against me. This is actually the third attempt to kind of take me down. I think that the intensity of the onslaught is directly related to how much attention and time I've devoted to COVID-19 on News from Underground. I mean, it only has a few thousand members, the listserv does, but everything I send out, the subject line ends up as a tweet. And even though I'm shadow banned on Twitter, so only a few of my followers know that I'm alive, there are 20,000 followers, at least nominally. And then there's the website where everything ends up, and that has a lot of traffic. So it's kind of a hub. I try to share some of the copious information out there that contradicts the official narrative. So the purpose of the petition is, first of all, to fire a shot across the bow as far as NYU is concerned. Mm. and let them know that this is not, this is unacceptable. This is intolerable. Even though I reckon that the vast majority of my colleagues here probably side with the student in this, because they are as, I hate to say it, but they seem to be as well informed about this crisis as she is. Hmm. I mean, they all read the New York Times and believe every word of it. Hmm. So the purpose is, first of all, to, you know, make a statement to my university about my academic freedom. But much more important is the fact that this is, as the petition puts it, a flashpoint in a much larger struggle. And it's not just about COVID-19. The blackout on the truth or truths concerning this virus and the catastrophic lockdowns is probably the most dangerous such blackout in the history of propaganda. Propaganda depends on censorship because it doesn't want contradiction. But it didn't start with COVID-19. You know, it's been going on for decades. It goes all the way back to the Kennedy assassination, when you were risking professional suicide if you, as a journalist or academic, threw yourself into the study of that murder, or King's murder, or Bobby's murder. And then it just got worse over the decades as the conspiracy theory meme, which the CIA weaponized in 1967, specifically to discredit critics of the Warren Report, as that meme spread and became more and more pervasive and everybody came to internalize it, as people now have, to disastrous effect. Everybody's internalized this. 9/11 was another milestone in censorship, punishment of academics who, you know, didn't get the memo. And then there's transgender medicine, there's Zionism, there's vaccines. You know, anyone who studies any of these things will be subject to, you know, slanders, slurs. Mm. They're anti-vaxxers, they're anti-Semites, they're transphobic, you know, so that there's no permissible discussion, no civil, informed, open back and forth. So the petition is really all about that.
Yeah, I would add geoengineering to your short list there. Yeah,
and, absolutely.
Yeah, and you and I both teach courses on conspiracy. You much more extensively than I do, but we should give a shout out to Lance DeHavend Smith's book, Conspiracy Theory in America, which is a seminal text and well-researched and accessible reading and really important here.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, my class will be reading it next week, and I am proud to say I asked Lance to write that book for a series I was editing at the University of Texas Press. He and I both, or each, you know, independently discovered that until 67, the phrase conspiracy theory was rarely used in U.S. journalism, and in no consistent way. Mm. But starting in 67, it's used more and more, and always in the same way. It's used to laugh off any discussion of what Lance calls state crimes against democracy, yes. Right? So I should have mentioned election theft is another taboo subject. I mean,
didn't you write a book about that, Mark?
Yeah, don't remind me. I wrote that Fooled Again, the book about the theft of the 2004 election, radically changed my whole career, because until then I was often welcome on NPR and had written op-eds in the New York Times and so on. So I was regarded as, you know, a somewhat sharp and edgy a critic of mass culture, TV, things like that, talk about media ownership. But once I came out with that book and it was blacked out by the corporate media and attacked in the left press as conspiracy theory, often by people I thought of as friends, you know, that really piqued my curiosity, you know. Conspiracy theory? What? Where does that come from? And I looked into it. And then Lance did too, on his own, for his own reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, he also put together a terrific compendium of works, writings about the theft of the election in Florida in 2000. Mm. You know, it's an indispensable reader on that theft. Mm-hmm. So he was also a very, you know, he was a professor at Florida Atlantic University and a very public critic of Governor Jeb Bush. So he was in, you know, various gun sites, I'm sure. But he and I both realized from just looking in the archives of the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time Magazine that something happened in 1967. And what that was CIA memo 1035-960, which is a must read. It's in the back of Lance's book. It's online. And it is a kind of playbook for CIA office station chiefs worldwide to use in recruiting their media assets to attack the works of people like Mark Lane. And then there were five what we would call talking points for these attacks. You know, that's the beginning of we now live in a world where you're accused of misinformation, fake news, junk science, all these terms that are completely false.
Or you're anti-something when you ask questions about it.
Yeah, exactly. You're anti. You're hateful.
Yeah.
You know, it all stems from the conspiracy theory meme, which is among the most successful propaganda efforts ever.
Yeah.
And we're now living with this, and the consequences are really, really catastrophic.
Yeah, they are. You know, it's funny because you and I teach, we teach undergraduates and graduate students, and I find many of my undergraduates insatiably curious about conspiracy as a concept and conspiracy theory. And it's interesting when you give them permission to kind of crack open the conversation. And treat it, as you described earlier, as a critical exercise. It's incredibly stimulating.
It is, and hopeful. I find it very
hopeful. Right. And I wanted to ask you about hope. I know you've been getting a lot of support from our mutual colleagues of ours around the country. I'm curious how are you doing? How is it going during this strange time?
First of all, like everybody else, I have to come to terms with the deliberate devastation of the society and the economy, and in my case, the city. Mm. You know, New York City is kind of a ghost town. Mm. I was just having an exchange right before we started this conversation with a good friend in the Netherlands, and she's been all over Europe. And it's the same there. And I know from my family, it's the same in Chicago. There's been a kind of global urbicide, U-R-B-I-C-I-D-E, right? Murder of cities, the murder of once great cities. That's the doing of the interests that are engineering this whole thing. And whose plans are explicit. I mean, it's all in The Great Reset by Klaus Schwab.
Yeah,
it's
Schwab's all in, book. Yeah,
Klaus Schwab's book. It's all in UN Agenda 2030, Agenda 21. It's all in black and white.
Event 201,
right?
Yeah. The plandemic exercises, the war game exercises. Yeah, it's astonishing. The roadmap is right in front of people.
But they won't read it because they think it's a conspiracy theory. Mm. See, this is the effect of that meme is to see what conspiracy theory really is. I mean, my own personal definition, my informal definition is something that, if true, you couldn't handle it. Mm. That's what a conspiracy theory is. Mm. So the idea that the government would kill the president, you know, the government would kill the greatest civil rights leader in modern history, the government would be implicated in a brutal attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. The government would do these things. People just don't want to go there. They don't want to think that, right?
Yeah, and it's funny, like, that we will accept the notion that the Nazis burned the Reichstag, right?
Yeah.
Or that Stalin murdered millions, or that Mao did the same, but somehow were exceptional.
Yeah, well, we don't do that. In fact, we've been doing it forever. I mean, remember the Maine, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's standard operating procedure for empires of all kinds to do that. And if people, and I'm referring here to my colleagues as well as students, were duly educated about, say, Operation Gladio, you know, this is all established history. Mm. If they knew what the CIA has pulled off over the decades all over the world, you know, if they knew about the history of eugenics and the Rockefellers' involvement in eugenics, they wouldn't be so wide-eyed and credulous and so intensely angry at those who bring these things up, you know. So you ask me how I'm doing. I mean, I'm like everybody else, trying to come to terms with what's happened to my world. And I'm also fighting this ridiculous battle at NYU. And the hardest part of that for me is that a significant number of very old friends in the academy, quite progressive, you know, I'm not going to name any names, I've heard of them all, they wouldn't sign the petition because they saw it as a referendum on masking. And they believe in what one of them called old epidemiological responses to the pandemic, as if masking had ever been done. I mean, it's an unprecedented, these mandates are unprecedented.
Yeah. Radical, extreme, unprecedented.
Extreme, so anyway, what I'm saying is that when you get right down to it, even some of the most sophisticated, progressive, aware intellectuals have succumbed to a propaganda drive that has entered them through every pore, you know. It isn't just something you read or watch. It's all pervasive. It's the air you breathe. And if you keep hearing that cases are exploding and the, you know, we're at grave risk because of this explosion of cases.
The case systemic,
I mean, this is a deliberate misuse of the word case. It just means people tested positive. It doesn't mean people are filling the hospitals. It doesn't mean people are dying in huge numbers. You know, the infection fatality rate is approaching zero, and hospitalizations are minimal, and, you know, many of them by now are for other conditions. But it's on the basis of this big lie that the lockdowns are now intensifying, the mask mandates are intensifying, even as ever clearer, more dramatic evidence of their uselessness, I'm talking about masks, and health risks come to light, you know? And it's just a very disorienting experience to see all this evidence come pouring out at the same time that people are closing their eyes ever more tightly to it and masking up, putting masks on their children, you know?
Outside and driving is what kills me.
It could kill you, right?
Yeah.
Because you can easily get run over.
Yeah.
I mean, there are reports, you look at the press nationwide, you find articles about these fatal accidents, people driving the wrong way down highways. Well, is it not possible that a number of those are due to masking? You know, Car and Driver, I sent this to my list, published an article noting that fatal car accidents have spiked this year. Okay, and they came up with some, it's alcohol abuse, you know, it's reckless behavior. Well, sure, that could be. People are drinking more, you know, now that society is collapsing. And they're maybe feeling reckless, maybe feeling suicidal, but they're also often driving with masks on at the wheel all by themselves.
Yeah.
And that messes with your mental clarity, you know?
Yeah.
It damages short-term memory. These are medical facts.
And
staring everybody right in the face, but they can't see it.
Yeah. What's been so interesting talking with you throughout this past 7 months is you're in one of the biggest cities in the United States, New York City. We're in probably one of the least populated areas in the United States, right? The second Vermont Republic, the Shire. And, you know, to your point about the 24/7 fire hose of disinformation, it impacts Vermonters in the same way that it does urbanites. And I went and I looked at the official numbers for Vermont today because I just wanted to clarify. We've had 58 official COVID deaths since March. 58. Two-thirds of them elderly people in two nursing homes with comorbidities. And today, Republican Governor Phil Scott extended the emergency for yet another extended period of time. And we actually had a cadre of Vermonters at the State House outside of his presser this morning that actually served him papers in the form of the Great Barrington Declaration.
Good.
Saying that this COVID catastrophe has got to stop. But it's been really strange, like you, to witness this civilizational collapse. And I think you feel it much more acutely because you're in a big urban area. I think you and I just had coffee not too long ago, or that was last fall. And, you know, Manhattan and Vermont are worlds apart. And yet, 5-hour car ride, and we're seeing the same,
right,
same kind of response. And otherwise, intensely smart sapiens, right, are closing their eyes to this. And I don't, it's very troubling.
Well, yeah, and a key element here is the function of Trump.
Yes. Can you speak about that? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, Trump, see, the thing about propaganda is that what it does is isolate one thing so that it's all you think about, and you think everything revolves around it. So, for example, COVID-19 now, as far as many people seem to be concerned, is the only cause of death.
Yes.
You know, nothing else kills you.
Yes.
Only COVID-19.
Yes.
So malnutrition, suicide, drug and alcohol abuse, domestic violence, medical neglect, despair, loneliness, all these, you know, demonstrable.
Unemployment, poverty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the lockdowns are affecting a kind of Holocaust worldwide. That is not hyperbole. That's a fact. Mm. But to these people, those deaths aren't happening. They don't matter. They're not important. Only the COVID deaths are important. Flu deaths don't matter, you know. So that COVID occupies that weird sphere where it's the only thing, the only disease in the world.
Mm.
Likewise, climate change, you know. Climate change is the only threat to the environment. Not 5G, certainly. Haven't heard Greta talk about that. Not Fukushima, which never comes up in the media, not air pollution, not water pollution, not plastics in the ocean, not glyphosate, you know, those aren't threats to the environment. Only climate change is that. And if marine life dies, it's because of climate change. You know, this is completely unscientific. It's based entirely on the success of that propaganda. It's only climate change. Yeah. All right. Trump, same thing. Trump is everything that's wrong with the United States. Trump is the only evil in post-war presidential history. George W. Bush, wonderful person. He does painting now. Nice guy. He goes on The View. He goes on Ellen DeGeneres. You know, they just love him. They think he's great. They love when George Bush Sr. Passed, you know, they treated it like the death of Abraham Lincoln, right? John McCain. This guy, an inveterate, rabid warmonger, bomb, Iran. Remember?
Yes.
This guy's treated like, you know, Mahatma Gandhi and George Washington rolled into one. He has this big state funeral. This is insane. I mean, they're even acting like John Bolton, who is essentially a mad dog, you know, because he came out against Trump, he's great. Also, the CIA and the FBI, they're marvelous. They're wonderful because they're protecting us from Trump/Putin, okay? this is moronic, but it, look, you know, propaganda works when you don't perceive it as such, and it works when it tells you what you want to hear, tells you what you agree with. So you ask any liberal, what's an example of propaganda? They'll say, oh, Fox News. Well, okay, Fox News is propagandistic, obviously. I've been writing about that for years. I've also been on Fox News, you know, kind of adversarial clinch with Bill O'Reilly. But, you know, they can't, they don't say the New York Times. They don't say NPR. They don't say the Atlantic. They don't say the BBC. They don't say the Guardian. You know, these are all strategic media partners of Bill Gates, you know, who to date has spent $250 million buying media all over the world. That's not propaganda to them because they like what it's telling them, you see? So Trump, the reason why you and I'm in New York, you're in Vermont, all these people, these intelligent people, refuse to listen to any evidence that the narrative is false because they think that's pro-Trump. And they make this bizarre leap that it's somehow pro-Trump to question lockdown. It's pro-Trump to question masking. It's pro-Trump to talk about the manifest benefits of hydroxychloroquine, which has saved countless lives around the world because Trump touted it, ergo, it can't possibly work, you know? So, whereas people on the right believe everything he says, people on the so-called left believe the opposite of everything he says. So what's the difference?
Yeah.
Side is more intelligent.
Yeah, I refer to it as Trump derangement syndrome versus Trump devotee syndrome.
Yeah,
and
right.
Either way, we lose, Mark.
Absolutely.
Either way, we lose.
I know a lot of people, good friends, you know, who actually harbor hopes that Trump is in some shrewd, erratic way planning an end run around this whole thing. And that's, I believe that's a delusion. I think that's wishful thinking. I don't think anybody who gets to be a presidential candidate gets to that point without having been vetted. This is a guy who was the protege of Roy Cohn. Okay. People should C-O-H-N, you know, do a little Google search on that guy.
Back to McCarthy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was the mentor to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is a narcissist and obsessed with himself, his image, and the illusion that he's a billionaire. He doesn't have an altruistic bone in his body. Now, it's true that he hasn't started any new wars, which, you know, we compare him to Obama, he's preferable. But he's ramped up some of the ones that are now going on. Mm-hmm. And while he has said things about Putin that sound conciliatory, Russia policy on his watch has become far more dangerous than it's ever been in post-war history. I mean, under Trump, the nuclear first strike policy has been liberalized to include cyber attack as a cause for actually launching a nuclear assault on Russia. That's not, you know, something that would happen under JFK, for example. People have actually compared Trump to JFK. Trump is not JFK. Trump says certain things, right? But his actions, I mean, he's the honcho on Operation Warp Speed. Now, some people say that his pushing the schedule, you know, so that a shot will come out by Election Day is his way of trying to discredit the whole enterprise. You know, maybe he's doing that. If he does have a vaccine injured child, maybe on some level he's conscious of the dangers here. But I think, you know, you ask how I'm doing, and that then raises the question of hope, which you also noted. And it does behoove us to discuss what might be some ways out of this.
That was going to be my last question for you. So let's talk about our ways out. Please, Mark.
Well, you know, I can only speculate along with you, because this being an unprecedented predicament that's been in the works, obviously, for decades, planned by extremely sophisticated players with enormous resources. You know, we're coming at it. We're trying to oppose it at a tremendous disadvantage. Certainly, I wouldn't harbor any expectations from either of the two political parties. So, you know, it pains me to say it as someone who devoted years to trying to get people to focus on the need to reform the voting system, because we are where we are in part because it's been profoundly corrupted. I don't really see that there will be much relation between the outcome of this election and the will of the electorate. I mean, I, for one, am ready to believe that Trump could beat Biden and in an honest race would. I don't trust the polls. I know a lot of black people. I don't know a single one who can stand Kamala Harris. And Biden is a standing joke. I mean, he's manifestly senile, as we used to say. He has dementia.
It's grotesque what the Democratic Party has, the position they've put him in. It's reprehensible.
It's elder abuse.
It is.
It's embarrassing.
It is,
you know?
Embarrassing.
And he makes Trump look like he's really sharp and compos mentis. But, you know, having studied all these election results for the last 20 years, and knowing that the system is now even more corrupt than before, and that the Democrats are every bit as capable of theft as the Republicans, having stolen the nomination 2 years in a row from Bernie Sanders, who said nothing about it. I don't see how this can be an honest race, nor do I think it's meant to be. I think that some kind of civil war is in the cards. The sequel to the COVID panic at its most intense was the George Floyd moment, which had the dual advantage of both intensifying national divisions, so that almost everybody you know is taking sides, either with BLM, Antifa, or the white supremacists. Everybody's squaring off against everybody else, and that's an imperial wet dream, you know, is to have everybody at each other's throats instead of paying attention to who's got all the money and power.
That's right.
And it also was the second of the 1-2 punch against the independent American economy, you know, the small businesses, offline economy. BLM has been instrumental in devastating, 40% of black-owned businesses, maybe more?
I think it's a little higher. Yeah.
Maybe higher. Yeah. So this is a catastrophe. And that moment, I believe, followed hard upon the first moment. And I think that there will be more along those lines happening. You know, I don't personally believe that there was a plot by white supremacists to kidnap Governor Whitmer. I don't believe that, any more than I believe that an organic squadron of Nazis stormed the Reichstag when Bobby Kennedy was over there talking in Berlin.
Right.
I don't actually believe that the armed turnout of white supremacists in Lansing, Michigan last spring, around the time of protests against the lockdown there, was real, you know? And this is just based on common sense informed by some awareness of how intelligence agencies operate and how certain incidents are orchestrated to make a particular impression, you know?
Yeah, we're looking at domestic color revolution, Mark.
Absolutely.
And that may not mean anything to some people watching, but please, you know, search for the color revolution phenomenon. I mean, as I tell my students, we're being politically programmed into tribal groups at every level of our communication system. Algorithmically, through advertising, through the way political theater is weaponized across the networks, it's really troubling. It's very troubling.
Well, it is, and you know, this speaks to the involvement of the intelligence apparatus in identity politics. Somebody like Ron Karenga, the Afro separatist who went on to found Kwanzaa. I think he's now a professor somewhere in California. He was, basically supported by the government in his attacks on the Black Panther Party. I think he murdered one or two of them. The Ford Foundation was funding Black separatist organizations. The Ford Foundation, when it was headed by McGeorge Bundy, back in the day. And this guy is no friend to Black liberation. This is all meant to divide people.
It's a divide and conquer strategy. And Ford Foundation is now one of the premier funders of Black Lives Matter, which is fascinating. And people ask me, why would the Ford Foundation fund Black Lives Matter? I said, well, if you're interested in dividing people into racial groups and pitting them against one another, this seems to be working quite well.
Well, it does. And I read that they received $100 million from the Ford Foundation. I don't know if it's that much, but they have been handsomely subsidized by them.
Yeah, and just one more thing on that. You know, I tell anyone who asks about civil rights and Black Lives Matter, I said, go look at the civil rights photographs from the 1950s and 60s. And the most startling and the coolest thing about them is how multiracially hued all of those photographs are. You've got Americans of all races banding together to challenge this apartheid system. That scared the pants off of the people at the Ford Foundation, among others. And so all you have to do is look at the photographic record and connect a few dots, and it's like, oh, all right.
Yeah, let me be even more specific with that. You know, one of the reasons that King was murdered when he was murdered was that he was planning a Poor People's March on Washington. Yes. Not a Black People's March, a Poor People's March. That could not be allowed to happen. Mm. And Fred Hampton, a lesser victim of assassination operations, in this case by the FBI, chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, and was murdered in his bed. An infiltrator in his household had drugged his wine at dinner, and he was unconscious. And Chicago police blasted their way into the apartment and killed him point blank range as he lay unconscious, and killed Mark Clark, another Panther who was there that night. And then there was a story that the cops had been fired on, and all this was made up. I bring it up because Fred Hampton was a very charismatic champion of revolution, whose appeal was pointedly made to all races. There's a documentary from 1971. I think it's called The Murder of Fred Hampton. And you can see, filled with footage, you know, the filmmakers had followed him around as he was giving his talks. And you could see in some rooms, more of his auditors were white than black. That can't be allowed to happen. He could not continue. King could not have his Poor People's March. Bobby Kennedy could not run for president because poor whites and blacks would have voted for him in force. JFK could not be allowed to run for re-election because he would have won with similarly broad support and on a kind of peace platform, okay? Forget that. That's not allowed to happen. So now we really have no unifying figures. We have two political parties that are completely enthralled to mighty interests. They're owned lock, stock, and barrel. So the question then is, which is the one we've been, it's been hanging here before us for the last 10 minutes, is what is it that we do? What exactly do we do? I mean, obviously, mass protest has now been weaponized against us. I mean, I know a lot of boomers get all choked up about BLM marches. They would often get kind of blubbery around Greta Thunberg, Those are permitted protests, okay? Those are allowed protests. Those are good protests. They're all wearing masks. which is, you know, itself a kind of dead giveaway as to how completely neutered they are. And they are approved protests because they don't really tackle anything serious. Anti-lockdown protests are treated as threats to all the rest of us, as putting everyone at risk. Mm. So the police response to those is becoming increasingly draconian, and overtly so, as in London, when thousands of people were there, having been driven away from Trafalgar Square, where the cops turned off their speakers. They were at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park, which is a site renowned for its tolerance of all points of view. And when Dr. Heiko Schoening got up, the German doctor who's part of that medical inquiry into the COVID crisis, got up to speak at Speaker's Corner, something like a dozen British cops arrested him in handcuffs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that the gloves are off and that mask is off, okay? We all have to wear masks, but the mask that they've worn for so long, the mask of commitment to democracy and free speech, tolerance of dissent, right? Marketplace of ideas, that mask is off, okay? And simultaneously, there's, you know, a kind of a rolling crackdown online with Facebook and Twitter and Google and all the rest of them variously collaborating on the disappearance of dissident information. So what I'm saying is we need to be more intent than ever on resistance. I mean, this could bum people out, this conversation, which I don't want it to do. Mm-hmm. Because any depression, any melancholy, any grief you may feel must be channeled into righteous anger. We can't let this happen.
Courage.
This
is courage, as we say, courage.
We need courage. Yeah. We need courage, and we need to think as creatively as possible about ways around this. Mm. You know, it's going to be different for people in different places.
Yes.
Some parts of the country, people are already in the hills, and others will head for the hills. For people like me, that's not an option. I'm in New York City. But the main thing is to continue to tell the truth and to spread that word, you know, to say no to censorship and make more and more people aware. Then we're at the point where enough of us are at least conscious of what's going on to see that the danger of fascism isn't Donald Trump, you know, this cartoon character who has no real power. The Proud Boys, what, are they going to take over the country? No. Totalitarianism is rolling out right now, right before our eyes, all over the world, with populations locked down, with you know, health passports being rolled out, with people being asked for their personal information when they go out to dinner, right? When apps end up on our phones without our even knowing they're there, with mandatory vaccination being planned, you know, for the whole planet. This is totalitarianism, okay? That's what this is. We're looking at it. And those people who refuse to see it, and those people who think Trump's the problem, they're accomplices, okay? It's a hard thing to say, but, and this includes many of my friends, many of my oldest friends, they are like the good Germans in the 30s. Mm. And if we do survive this, as I believe we can and will, we will look back, our children will look back at this moment and wonder why it is that so many people went along with it. And those who did go along with it are going to have some explaining to do and are going to have some guilt to get over for what they've done.
Wow. Yeah. That's perhaps a good place to end. And I would encourage our listeners, our viewers, to find News from Underground. There are a lot of Vermonters up here, Mark, who are reading you and your news out of New York City regularly, and we are organizing. And yeah, we've held a number of freedom picnics unmasked around the state, and people are emerging from their caves and their basements and realizing that we've got work to do. So,
let me stress again, the crucial thing is to reach across boundary lines.
Yes. Yeah.
Those who consider themselves left have got to get over their Trump loathing and their knee-jerk assumption that there are all these neo-Nazis out there. They've got to reconnect with their commitment to the working class, and that includes the white working class. Black people who believe in gun ownership should make common cause with whites who do. You know, whites whose interest in guns isn't based just on kind of racist paranoia. There's got to be alliances formed. You know, there has to be a rediscovery of we the people, right?
Yeah,
That's a tall order.
It is a tall order. Yeah, I refer to early and often to Team Human. We need to see past our tribal, our polarized tribal differences into our common humanity. And that, of course, was the great vision of people like the Kennedys and Martin Luther King and others. And to the extent that that's the greatest threat to the powers that be and the greatest hope for the rest of us, let it be so, I think. Let it be so.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, Mark, it's been such a pleasure, and we will continue to work on your behalf with the petition. And if there's anything else we can do, please don't hesitate to call on us up here in Vermont. We've got your northern back, my friend.
And I may end up relocating maybe not in a college town.
Yeah, exactly. We would welcome you with open arms, and maybe we can get you up here soon, at least for a visit. Is there anything else that you want to share with us before we go?
No, I think we've kind of covered it. I just I do want to leave people with a feeling of commitment to overcoming this, you know, and not with a sense of despair. You despair when you stumble into certain revelations all at once. It all hits you like a ton of bricks. But when you realize it's been in the works for a very long time, the interests pushing it know what they're doing, we just have to play catch up now and figure out how to deal with things like a cashless economy, maybe food shortages, who knows. But we have to prepare ourselves for a long, dark winter and the eventual spring, you know, that will bloom, you know, it will. But it won't if we don't make it happen.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the prophetic words of George Orwell. In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. So thank you for telling the truth, Mark. I'm going to do a quick sign off for us, and then we'll say goodbye. You've been watching Plan VTV, the show about Vermont independence. I'm Rob Williams, the publisher of VermontIndependent.net. We've, of course, been covering the COVID since February 2020, and we rely on our crowdsourced researchers and our network of independent news and critical thinkers, and Mark Crispin Miller is certainly at the top of that list. So, Mark, thank you so much. Good luck down there. We're thinking of you, and we hope to see you again soon. V for Vermont.